If you would please help me to welcome our speaker tonight. This is Adam Kay from Bloomsbury, New Jersey.
One thing I've never been accused of is talking lowly, so anyway, my name is Adam and I'm an alcoholic, and it's really great to see everybody here. I was actually honored to when I was asked to come to this group. I've heard so much about it, and I see that it's a full house, it's well attended, and that's just really jazzes me up, man. It gets me going. I belong to the Bloomsbury Believers Group in Bloomsbury, New Jersey. I live in Phillipsburg, which is kind of right next door. My sponsor is Ed C. and his sponsor is Pete. I believe in sponsorship wholeheartedly. And if you've come here to hear a tale of sex, booze, and rock and roll, you've come to the right place. Minus the sex and the rock and roll. So anyway, I have a tale of booze for you. However, we'll concentrate a little bit. I mean, How It Works always says it. It kind of said what it was like, what happened, and what we are like now. So I guess I'll start off. I was born in a small town, probably about 45, 50 miles east of here in Manville, New Jersey. Some of you may have heard it. If you do know Manville, New Jersey, that pretty much qualifies me to be in AA. Because Manville was one of those towns that had a bar on every corner. John's Manville was in full force back in the 60s and 70s. And there were three shifts running, so the bars were open 24 hours a day. I have five brothers and a sister, and we all get along. And unfortunately, I guess for me, I'm the only alcoholic. I guess fortunate for the family. I'm the only alcoholic out of everybody. Mom and Dad were not alcoholics. They were tried and true Catholics, went to church every Sunday, Mom sometimes every day. My brothers, all professional people as they grew up. We were a close-knit family. We were probably one of the most functional families that you could imagine. We grew up in a three-bedroom ranch house. So you figure Mom and Dad had one bedroom, sister had the middle bedroom, and all four boys, or five or six boys, whatever it was at the time, had bunk beds in one bedroom. So we all grew up very very close-knit, and I tell you what, I wouldn't have it any other way. If I had to do it all over again, I would probably do it that way. My drinking pretty much started when I was about 14, I'm going to say 8th grade into 9th grade, as a lot of folks. I started off, my first drink I remember was Tango. I don't know if you remember Tango, but it came in like a little fifth bottle, and it was like orange juice, well, orange drink almost, like, and vodka. And I drank that, and I liked the warm sensation going down and really enjoyed myself. Got me buzzed. I had that first perfect buzz. And it was many years after that I continued to try to get that buzz, never to achieve it, only to over or under, mostly overdo it in order to get that buzz. But my drinking pretty much took off with very little consequences. My dad had a good name in the town. My brothers were all sports figures and stuff. Some of my favorite times were in high school because I was sports. I played football. I was track and field. Track and field was my favorite sport, bar none. As you can tell, I was a distance runner. No, shot put, discus, and javelin. That was my bag, and it was during track season really where I realized the powers of alcohol and how it could make me better than what I was. In track and field, you could pretty much for any of you that have participated in it, you could pretty much go in a newspaper and see what teams are doing. So I could look in the newspaper and I say, okay, this kid from Roselle Park, he threw the javelin 150 feet and the kid threw it 130 feet in the discus, and then he threw it 45 feet in the shot put. So you can pretty much gauge how you're going to be because you know what your best throws are. And so I pretty much recited and just said we were playing Roselle Park and we were going away that day. And I figured I was going to take maybe a first or a second in the discus. I was going to take maybe a third in the javelin, and I wasn't going to place in the shot put from my throws. And I decided to take 5 airline bottles of Seagram 7s. Why Seagram 7? I don't know. But I just took Seagram 7 with me. And I drank that on the school bus on the way to the track meet. And lo and behold, I had my best ever throw in a discus and took first. I had my best ever throw in a javelin and took first. And I had my best ever throw in a shot put and took second. So alcohol had made me throw farther, you know, like that kids commercial, run faster, jump higher, throw farther. And so I felt the alcohol was the elixir. It was my deal. I found out, you know, a little bit quickly that I could drink a little bit more than the other kids. And I was always the one that was tagged during the parties at other people's houses when the cops came knocking at the door. It's, Adam, you answer it. Why? Oh, well, you always appear straight. Okay, whatever. And I'd answer the door, and the cop would say, Adam, what are you doing? I said, we'll just have to turn the music down. Okay. And then we go on about our business. And things went along, and I always picked out those guys that could drink more than me because I didn't want to be that guy. And then rather quickly, those guys started to fade away. I couldn't find them anymore. Thus, I became the one who drank the most out of everybody. Oh, Adam could drink anybody under the table. He could do this. He could do that. And I kind of wore that as like a badge of honor. That was like, that's my gig, man. I was the best drinker ever. MVP, all-star, superstar. And I got my driver's license, and I celebrated my 18th birthday with a 7-ounce glass of beer in every bar in Manville, which at that time was 21. So I had 21 7-ounce glasses of beer, and I had a 1973 Buick Century. And I decided to, because it was kind of sputtering, so I wanted to blow the carbon out of the engine. And so I went on Route 22 in Bridgewater, and I decided to blow the carbon out of the engine at 103 miles an hour. And at that time, the brand new, brand spanking new First Day Bridgewater Task Force was on the scene. And I got pulled over by 3 marks and 4 unmarks. And cop looked at my license, and he goes, oh, I see it's your birthday today. Because at that time, they have your birthday right on a license. And I said, yes. He goes, we're going to give you a birthday present. I said, what's that? And he goes, we're going to let you go with an 80 and a 55. Thank you very much, officer. Didn't even think about the drinking part or anything. I was stone sober at that when I saw all those lights around me. Nothing like cop lights to sober me up. So there I was, 18 years old, and I had probably like 8 or 9 points. I had to go to driving school and all of that. I started to turn it around. I said, I got to drive a little bit more safe or not drive that much at all. So I always had my friends drive because I always had the money. I had a job. I worked at Somerset Bakery back then. And Somerset Bakery was the best bakery in the world. Rye breads, hot rye breads coming out of the oven at 4 o'clock in the morning, hard rolls, jelly donuts, cream donuts, you name it. I was like the favorite kid on the block because all of the neighbors, they got hot rye breads in their mailboxes when I was coming home, and they looked forward to that. Well, the cops, they used to come into the, and it's true, cops do come in, they like donuts. They came into the bakery at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they saw me sitting there at 16 years old drinking beer. And they just turned the other cheek, turned the other eye, blind eye, whatever you want to call it. They just turned, and it didn't matter. The one that actually got me the most was my brother, my next oldest. I'm the youngest, by the way, out of all of the kids. And my next oldest brother, he saw me going into the tavern right across the street from the bakery. It was Petey's Tavern. I don't know what it's called. It's called something else now. But Petey's Tavern, I used to go in there with one of my other older brothers' varsity jacket on, so the year on a sleeve matched my age and all of that. And I was drinking Cokes all the time. I would go in there for breaks and just honestly drink mugs of Coca-Cola. Now, one day the bartender brought over a small glass with a red swizzle stick in it. And I said, what's this? And he goes, rum and Coke, that's what you wanted. I said, yeah. Until he took my money and I said, whoa. That's a little bit more than a mug of Coke, but I liked the way that rum and Coke made me feel. A little too expensive, a little too pricey, so I switched over. They had Genesee Cream Ale on tap. And so I fell in love with Genesee Cream Ale. That was my new girlfriend. And so it was a short-lived romance, though, because my brother saw me drinking over there. He called up the bartender from across the street, and he says, "Hey, you see that kid in the orange hat?" Guy goes, "Yeah, Max DiBella, may his soul rest in peace." Said, "Next time you give him a beer, card him." So he brings over a mug of Jenny with the smile on his face, the mustache, that bartender mustache, and he goes, "Here you go, son." And I said, "Thank you." And he goes, "By the way, could I see some ID?" And I'm like, I'm gonna Ralph Cramden all over again. But by that time, I realized I could pretty much do a handstand to the next bar in town, so it wasn't gonna matter to me whether I could get served anywhere I wanted. I kind of looked older. I had the deeper voice, and it just kind of everything went together. So my drinking progressed rather quickly. I graduated from beer into the little bit harder stuff, I would say. Kamikazes, Red Deaths, all of those, you know, neat mixed drinks that were real pretty color. Only instead of doing them in shots, I did them in 32-ounce glasses. And I had met my future ex-wife then, and we were married for about 3 years. We did it. I was working out in Hillsboro, and I lost that job. So we decided that we could live comfortably on New Jersey unemployment out in Western Pennsylvania. So I moved all the way out to Mercer, like exit 2 on Route 80, and nobody told me that New Jersey unemployment eventually ran out. But it did, and I could not afford to stay out there, so I decided to do a commute back and forth to New Jersey and just go back and see my wife every weekend or every other weekend. That lasted for all of about 3 or 4 months, and she moved back to Raritan with me, and we were living in her brother's house. And by that time, my drinking had just gotten so out of hand. I really, to tell you the truth, I don't remember very much of that three-year marriage that I had. But we split up. She pretty much told me, you know, get the hell out, and I did. And I had no place to live, so I was, at that time, I got a job at a neat pharmaceutical company. Ground level, very ground level. Delivering mail, starting up for like $14,000 a year. It's like, wow, real high roller. But the place had a shower in it because it had a gym, so it had a shower. It had a cafeteria, so it had food. And it had a lot of room, and I was in charge of all of the loading docks, so I had a place to sleep. So I actually took up residence at my work, unbeknownst to them. The only thing is that the cafeteria closed on the weekends. So I didn't know what to do. Well, at that time, I was also a disc jockey. And disc jockeying, it provided a unique way of getting food. What I would do is I put on my tuxedo, and I would go off to places like the Pines in Edison or the Martinsville Inn up in Martinsville during a Saturday or a Sunday when they were going to be having weddings or whatever. And these people thought I was the DJ walking around in cocktail hour. I was eating bacon-wrapped scallops and 7-and-7s and screwdriver. And, you know, I was eating high on the hog. I couldn't wait for the weekends to happen. It was good stuff. There I was, you know, the alcoholic thinking, always trying to get over somewhere or another. And that's where I was. I look back at it, and I said, you know, it's pretty inspirational at times. But then I looked at how sad I really was. It really was a sad way of life. I eventually got promoted in that job and started earning some more money. And I met my next wife. And I met her at Lanco in White House Station, New Jersey. She was the register girl. I, the deli clerk. A match made in heaven. Because I have my friends come in and I would cut them up 4 or 5 pounds of lunch meat. And I would say, go through that line, and she would just ring up 50 cents here, 75 cents there, and we would go down the shore the next day with a big picnic basket full of stuff. And again, angle shooting, conniving, cheating, stealing, get a theme of where I was at. That's where I was. But we fell in love, and then that quickly soon faded away when she got pregnant. And I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I said, listen, I'll help you get rid of the kid. And she said, I don't think so. And I'm like, what? and we weren't married yet. So I said, well, come on, you bet. So I did another self-respecting alcoholic thing. I kicked her out. I said, get out then if you're not going to do that. And I took residence with another female who I enjoyed the company of at that time. Well, unbeknownst to me, she snuck around the back door and caught up with my dad. And I respect my dad. He's since been gone for about 8 years now. I dearly love him. He's my hero. He was a World War II vet, Battle of the Bulge, Bronze Star, you name it, Catholic guy, went to church, took his kids to church. He was everything that I wanted to be. And she got a hold of him, and he came up to me and said, you better make her honest. Back then, that was the right thing to do. So I said, okay, and we got married, and she was 8 months pregnant. I'll never forget my anniversary, though. Because my son is 24 years old, we just celebrated 24 years of marriage in June. When he turns 25, we'll hit our silver anniversary this coming up June 24th. So it's one of those things. Yeah, I won't forget the anniversary. Anyway, I had another child soon after that. So we had two that were pretty close proximity, and we moved into a place in Raritan, New Jersey, And that's pretty much where the downfall started, because I was still, you know, I was working now. I had two kids. I had the car, the house payment. Everything was going swell. But then there was this place right on the Somerville Circle called the Gateway, the big pyramid. If you see it, it looks like a big rocket ship or pyramid. They have something similar over in Greenbrook, the Ivory Tower. And at the base of that pyramid is a bar. And one of my friends became the bar manager there, which means that I became a substitute bartender, which entitled me to drink for free whenever I wanted to. So if it's for free, it's for me. And I took full advantage of that because I lived 1,265 steps away from my house. On the way back from the Gateway to my house, it was 2,420 steps, because you had to account for the sideways. Well, I guess somewhere along the line, somebody must have spoken to my wife about that other Al-Anon thing. And all of a sudden, brochures were starting to get left around the house. Okay, well, I could read them here or there. It doesn't matter. And then all of a sudden, she stopped making my drinks. Why would she stop making my drinks? I work hard all day. I go to the bar and work hard there. And then I come home, and you should make me a drink. Well, she wasn't putting up with it. So I taught my kids how to make drinks. And they knew. My kids are smart. Don't underestimate your children. If you have children, don't underestimate them, because they know exactly when Dad gets lubed. I used to drink these 32-ounce cups, New Orleans Saints mugs, 32-ounce, and I would fill them with ice a little bit, and I would fill it with vodka a lot, and then put a little Diet Pepsi, because I have to watch the figure. And so after that first one, if you tried to connive me or get something from me or ask me a question, don't bother until that first one's down. Halfway through the second one, that was the magic zone. The kids would come up, Dad, can we order Chinese tonight? Dad, can we have pizza tonight? Dad, can I have $20 for allowance? Wallet came out, food was coming in. Man, it was just, you know, open day. But after that, once I got on the third one, just like the big book says, you found just the wrong time to become tight. And I became tight. I never physically abused my wife. However, emotionally, I beat her more than what Mike Tyson ever beat his worst opponent. Emotionally, I was the biggest cad that ever lived. I didn't realize how bad it was until once in a meeting I heard a lady speak that she was both physically and emotionally abused. And she said she would rather take a couple punches to the head than get abused emotionally the way she was from her husband. I had no idea that those feelings existed. until she spoke, and I took that to heart. I still make amends to this very day. I constantly make amends to her for what I've done. She's since forgiven me, and thank God. I thank God for that every day. Well, anyway, I came home one night, and there were two Raritan police officers on the porch, and they said, listen, you're not allowed to come in here. I said, I live here. Yeah, of course I could come in. He goes, no, you don't understand. Your wife doesn't want you here. There's a protection from abuse. And I'm like, I never hit her. They go, you don't have to. Well, okay. And this was the chief of police now, who was a lifelong friend from Manville. He was the chief of police in Raritan. He said, Adam, I knew you when you were growing up. I knew you when you were a young man. He goes, you've changed. I no longer wish to be your friend. And that hurt. That hurt a lot, because I always took a lot of pride in the friendships that I had. And I always thought that I treated them the right way. In reality, I treated them like crap. I treated those relationships like crap. And so there I was, out and about. The cop said, okay, you have a choice. You could go to rehab or you could go to jail. Well, that's a hard one. I think I'll take rehab. Yeah, okay. So they sent me off. They sent me off to a lovely place called Carrier Clinic, and I was there for 2 days when Carrier turned around and said, "Sorry, you're not allowed to stay here. Your insurance doesn't cover it." And I'm like, "Oh, great! I'm trying to get sober now, and they're kicking me out." And so they sent me to a place down in Moorestown, New Jersey. I have no idea. I don't think it still exists, but it was like cinder blocks. It was nothing like Carrier. Carrier was like a palace compared to this place. And you got lousy food, and it's like you had to make your bed, and you had to do all of this stuff. And I didn't want to say, I'm too old to be doing this. So I went along with it anyway, and I started listening, and they started pounding the first three steps down. First step, second step, third step, first, second, third, and it's like, okay. And, of course, they gave you a big book along the way, and I read the big book. I'm pretty well read. I read the whole thing from cover to cover, so I knew that. And there I was, coming out of rehab after 27 days, and I'm ready to come home to my wife, and she's like, not yet. What do you mean, not yet? Come on, I'm sober almost a month now. And she goes, not yet. And so I ended up, through the good graces of a good friend of mine, he took me in. Because I was still paying child support, rent, car insurance, all of that. I told the judge, I only got $40 left over for the month. He says, I don't care. Come on, man, I'm a good guy. I'm a good father. After a few weeks or so, my wife, little by little, decided to let me back into her life and the kids' lives. Went to Food Town over there, bought some food for them, took the kids fishing one day on a picnic, you know, kind of normal stuff that normal dads do. So that started going off pretty good, and then she finally invited me back into the house. Well, the first day out of rehab, I went to a group, and this was on a June 6th of 1991, I went into a group called the Bradley Gardens Group of AA. If you don't know Bradley Gardens Group, they're kind of like the Bloomsbury Group. Very strong. A lot of old-timers. Old-time AA. No talk about drugs. No talk about anything except alcohol. They had guys in there named Jailhouse Al and Rapacious Tom. I always thought AA was like a mafia. You know, you hear these nicknames, Jimmy the Cane, and, you know, everybody's got different nicknames for everybody. So I walked in there, and they go, are there any newcomers? And I said, yeah, I'm a newcomer. I said, I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic. And and they said, okay, shut up for 90 days now. I'm like, what? And what do you mean, shut up for 90 days? And they say, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. And I'm like, oh, great. But I found out that there were other meetings around in the area that would let me share my experience, strength, and hope. At that time, my pathetic drunkalog, that's what it was. My first job in AA at the Bradley Gardens Group, my first job was cleaning ashtrays. Anybody remember cleaning ashtrays at smoking meetings? Unbelievable. Bradley Gardens, the smoke was so thick you could cut it with a knife, but we would clean those ashtrays out, and they were the sparkliest ashtrays you ever want to see. I did the best job that I could, and I said, these people just don't realize what my potential is. They have me cleaning ashtrays, for crying out loud. And so after about a month or so of cleaning ashtrays, they go, "Adam, we got a new job for you." And I said, finally, you're coming up with something good. What do you got for me? They go, "We're going to make you chairman." I'm like, "Yes." And I looked around for the book, and they go, no, not that chairman." I said, "What do you mean?" "We want you to set the chairs up at the beginning of the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, we want you to break the chairs down." And I'm like, "You sons of..." Well, I did that. And it's probably one of the most godsends that has ever happened, because it made me get to the meetings early, and it made me stay late. And I got to know people in that group. And then we started going on speaking commitments. On 90 days, my sponsor had me on my first speaking commitment. And I was scared to death. And I spoke for all of like 10 minutes. And I was like, I don't think anybody could go longer than that. Well, after being a trained DJ then and speaking in front of a lot of people, I got used to speaking in front of people, so that wasn't a big deal after all. But those days of going on speaking commitments, Bradley Gardens would bring 4 carloads of people. There would be a leader, 2 speakers, and probably about 10 or 11 support people. And we would go to places. We would go to Cape May. We would go up to Booton. We would go out to Clark, New Jersey. We would go all over the state of New Jersey pretty much. And those were the meetings before the meeting, the meeting during the meeting, and the meetings after the meetings, like getting 3 meetings within a space of about 5 hours. I heard some people talking about going to 3 meetings today. This is their 3rd meeting today. Congratulations. Either you love AA coffee or you're trying to get sober. That's a fantastic thing. I went to as many meetings as I could. When I first started off back in 91, I was going to 2, sometimes 3 meetings a day. My sponsor, who I got, and he allows me to use his last name. His name's Jack Quinn. Jack has about 45 years. He celebrated 45 years in the program of AA this past year. Jack took me under his wing back then, and we actually worked at the same place, same pharmaceutical company. So we had a meeting all the way into work, and then we would hit a lunchtime meeting in Bridgewater, and then we would have a meeting all the way back from work, which was a 45-minute commute. And so, I mean, and Jack never preached at me. He never preached. He never told me, you got to do. Jack led me through the steps like he was led through the steps, as they're outlined in the big book. And when we went through them, he kind of explained them a little bit, but then he let me live my own life. He let me make my own mistakes sometimes. Those first 3 steps, though, even though I was in rehab and did those first 3 steps, he insisted that we do them again. And so he asked me if I was powerless, and I indeed said I was. If I surrender, I completely surrender. That my life was unmanageable. And at that time, I was like, see, that's where you get me. Is my life really unmanageable? Because I still have my wife. I still have my house, my kids, my cars. There was no DUIs in the picture. I didn't get around. I wasn't in jail. None of that stuff happened to me. No consequences for my drinking. And he said, "Adam, let me just ask you a simple question." I said, "What is it, Jack?" And he said, "When you don't drink, could you tell me what your night is going to be like when you go to sleep?" I said, "Yeah, probably going to sit down on my recliner. I'm probably going to have a soda, maybe some chips. I'll watch TV, get really tired, go upstairs and go to sleep." He goes, "Okay, fair enough." He goes, "Now, if you had 1 drink during the day, could you tell me what your night was going to be like?" And I said, honestly, to answer that, I could not. There's a good chance that I could have gone home. I could have sat in a recliner, had some chips, watched TV, got tired and went to bed. But there was no guarantee for that. Sometimes I would wake up in Las Vegas. Sometimes I'd wake up in New York. Sometimes I'd wake up in Trenton. Because I forgot to switch trains at the Raritan Valley line coming out of Newark. That's where it goes. The train goes to Trenton. You don't want to go. Don't go to Trenton at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not a fun place to be. So Jack quickly showed me how unmanageable that my life was. And so we went on to the second step. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could reside. I certainly believed in a power greater than myself. I'm a Christian. I believe that Jesus is my higher power. I don't say that everybody should believe in that. I don't want to preach or push anything down anybody's throat, but at that time I was pretty adamant about that. That was my higher power, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And could he believe? Could he bring me to sanity? And it's like, yeah, I believe he could, because the drinking really took me to dark places. And I believe that God really could have restored my sanity. So then I took that third step, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. It was really easy to turn the bad things over. But some of the stuff that was going okay in my life, I kind of wanted to hold on to. And Jack explained to me that it was the all or nothing deal. You know, if you only half measures availed us nothing. It didn't avail us half. It availed us nothing. So quickly, I got into that mindset that I turned my entire will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Then it was time for that fourth step inventory, which I heard a lot of people always shudder about. Oh, no, fourth step. I can't do that. I'm not ready for it. And Jack, he just kind of kept the motivation going. We went through these steps rapidly. And so I went there, I did that fourth step inventory, and I said, well, I know I'm leaving something out. He goes, don't worry about it. You have another chance to do it later. So I did that fourth step inventory, and I sat down with him right after I was finished with that, and I did my fifth step, and I waited. I waited for him to shun me and say, I don't want you nowhere near me anymore. And Jack said, simply, he looked me in the eye, and he goes, Adam, you're not as bad as you like to think you are. Wow. Okay. Well, that wasn't too hard to take. So then on to the sixth step. I went to that sixth step, and it's like, you know, defects of character. What am I supposed to do, God? Am I ready for God to remove? Yeah, I'm ready for God to remove. Well, maybe not that one. Or maybe not that one. Maybe it says all defects of character. Okay, I got to get on the page. So I get on that defects of character page. And okay, I finally want God to remove all my defects of character, how hurtful it may be. And then went on to that seventh step, and it says, humbly ask them to remove my shortcomings. At that time, I was starting to get real spiritual in my life. I was really starting to ramp up. I was going to this church. I was listening to the gospel. I was doing all of this stuff, and my spirituality was building, and I could feel it oozing out of me. I could get the tingles when I, you know, hear certain things, and it's like when I sing in the worship service, I start crying, and it's like, yeah, this stuff is great. I love this. And when I asked God to humbly remove my shortcomings, first I asked Him, God, could you please make me aware of the shortcomings that I have. Be careful what you ask for, because God will definitely put it on your heart as He did on mine. And the shortcomings to which I thought were assets were actually shortcomings and big deficits. One of the things that I used to think that I was great at was my joking around, my wit, my fantastic wit, and sharp and funny and quick. And Jack said, and I listed that on my inventory as being an asset, because I listed both assets and deficits. And he goes, do you really think that that's an asset? I said, well, yeah. He goes, do you ever cut anybody down with that? I'm like, damn it. Yeah, moved over to the deficit side. So there I was working on my shortcomings. I truly believe, and I've instituted that that seventh step is become a daily practice in my way of life now. Along with the 10, 11, and 12, the seventh step has become a focal point in my. So I then moved on to the eighth step and got ready to make amends. And, you know, I had my amends list all. I was already ahead of that one, you know. And Jack was like, whoa, slow down, Adam. Now I had it made out. I said, well, who are you going to make amends to first? I said, my ex-wife. And he goes, okay, let's look at your motives. I said, what are you talking about, motives? He goes, no, why do you want to make amends to your ex-wife first? I hadn't talked to her in probably years. I'm married again, have kids. Man, I've been forgotten. And deep down inside, my motive was maybe she'll see how good I'm doing and want to get back with me. Yeah, this little lump of sugar right here. Well, Jack put a big red X through that one. He goes, you're going to wait a little while before you make that amends. I'm like, oh, great. So I made the other amends, the simple ones, the ones to family and stuff. And even though they seem simple, they're still, when you do it heartfelt and humbly, it exhausted me. It exhausted me when I did those. They were that heartfelt. There was one amends, funny amends story. Well, it's funny now. It wasn't then. I was in the process of buying a house with my wife and the kids. We're going to buy it in Phillips. This is our Phillipsburg house. And got all of the paperwork in order with the realtor. And he's like, okay, everything's fine and normal and ready to go except for this one thing. And there's a $4,000 judgment against you from, I don't know, 8-10 years back. And I'm like, what's this from? And it was from a landlord. I forgot. I had rented a place in Quakertown, New Jersey. And he did not want to fix the roof, so I refused to pay the rent for like 10 months. And I snuck out like a thief in the night, got a U-Haul, packed all the stuff up and gone in one night. And this came back. He filed a judgment in Hunterdon County Court. And so I said, okay, I have to make amends to this guy. And I went back and I asked Jack again. Now, sponsors are not financiers, they're not marriage counselors, they're not anything, but Jack went above and beyond the call of duty, and he lent me $4,000, thinking that I was going to pay him back. And I went to this guy, called him up, he said, yeah, I'll meet you in the parking lot in Flemington, and so we went to this parking lot, and I got out of the car with that, you know, kind of cocky smile, and I had the envelope in my hand, and I'm like, you know, I'm sorry that I did this. And he goes, you know what, I don't know if I want to take that money or not. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? He goes, I know if I take this money, that'll settle a judgment, and you'll be able to get your mortgage. Dude, I'm really sorry. Really, really sorry. Boy, talk about the apple getting stuck in the throat at that. Well, he goes, if it wasn't for your wife and your kids who did absolutely nothing to me, he goes, I wouldn't take this money because personally I think you're a scumbag. And I deserve that. And I look back, Jack let me do that amends knowing that my motives were impure. My motive was not to make amends, to mend that situation between that ex-landlord and me. My motive was to get my mortgage. And I got exactly what I deserved, and I realized it. Jack just kind of had that little half smile on, and he goes, so how'd that amends go? Never mind. So anyway, the amends process changed drastically for me. All of those amends after, from that point on, were heartfelt amends. The 10th step, sought through prayer and meditation. Praying was always one of my strong points. I really believe that praying helps. Somewhere along the line, I used to pray selfishly. I used to pray for stuff for myself. You know, how about the $1 million lottery? How about a new car? How about this and that? My prayers today are no longer about me. My prayers today are about others. It was AA that taught me about that. I mean, I look at the third step prayer. And it says, remove me from bondage of self so I might be of use, ultimate use to you and others. The 7th step prayer, you know, remove these character defects so I may be of use to others. It always points towards others. So I said, there's a reoccurring theme there. So I guess helping others was what I need to do. So I did the meditation part. I learned that meditation was my part of listening to God. I give him my petitions first, and then I listen for those answers. When I do something wrong in my life, and believe me, I do a lot of wrong things. When I do something wrong, 9 times, probably 10 times out of 10, God convicts me. There's something that hurts. Where that hole where the alcohol used to fill was void, that's where it hits real hard. And so it's like, wow. Okay, I just can't be doing this stuff anymore. And I found out it's those shortcomings when I started to replace those shortcomings. When God took those shortcomings away, I had to replace it with something, because otherwise it was just a vacuum. It was a void. And so I heard a real neat thing, and I started following it. Like, one of my things was, I wanted to read the Bible more. And I sat in this lazy boy, and I have my little table next to me where I keep my drink and my chips and stuff, and the remote control, and my Bible. And whenever I went in that chair and I wanted to do something, the first thing that I reached for was the remote control. And I turned the TV on, and after that, you know, sometimes I turn on Joel Osteen or something, and, you know, be, okay. And then click the channels. It was some strange reason, like 3 o'clock in the morning, some TV preacher was on, I don't know who it was, but they said, I want you to try something, and, you know, if you want to read your Bible. And I'm like, okay. And they said, next time you get up in the morning, take the batteries out of the remote control and put them in another room. So I did that. I'll give it a shot. And I took the batteries out, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't remember the next day. And next morning I wake up, and I go plop myself down in a chair, and I hit the click, it's not going on. I'm like, what the heck is this? And then I look, oh, there's no batteries. Now I had a choice. I could get up and go to the other room and get the batteries, or I could pick up the Bible that's real close to my chair. So I started to pick the Bible up. After 3 weeks of that, it's become a daily habit. I pick my Bible up every day now, and I don't touch the remote control until after I have read the Bible and done my other things that I need to do. My spirituality has grown. Something happened. I had about 7.5 years of sobriety, and I was going strong. I was still doing at least 9-10 meetings a week. I'm a big NASCAR lover, so I went down to Dover to watch a NASCAR race. And I got a fateful phone call at about 8 o'clock at night on a Saturday night. And it was my brother said, Adam, you need to get home. Brenda's in the hospital, my wife. And so I just grabbed the tent, threw it in the back of the car, and 90 miles an hour up Route 1 and into Doylestown. She was at Doylestown Hospital. She was bitten by a spider. Her heart stopped 3 times. They had to paddle her 3 times in the ambulance on the way back. I got to the hospital. My pastor was there. My kids were there. They were crying. And my pastor goes, what are you thinking? And I'm like, I don't know. I went in to see her. She's got tubes hanging out, and she was in a coma. So I said, I got to talk to the doctor. The doctor called up and said, Adam, if your wife makes it through the night, which we don't think she's going to, she's going to be a vegetable. Okay. What do you got for me now, Lord? I went into the chapel at Doylestown Hospital, and strangely, no coincidences. I don't believe in coincidences. I turned that big Bible open, and it opened to the book of Job. And I had never read that book before. And I found out what Job went through, and what I was going through wasn't so bad after all. Other people have seen worse, been through worse, experienced worse. And my pastor said, what are you thinking, Adam? And I said, well, if there's any silver lining, I know if she passes, she's going to be with the Lord. Silver lining. Starting to look at things positively because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. People sharing their experience, strength, and hope with me. And now it's my turn to receive, because I was always a giver. I was a gracious, gracious giver. Love giving things away. Presents, money. Well, don't be getting too excited. All kinds of things. Giving makes me feel good. Whenever somebody says, hey, Adam, would you vote about this? I'm no, I'm good. Adam, if I give you, no, I'm okay. Everything's fine. I'm good. Trust me. Everything's fine. Wise old Jack. He goes, how do you feel when you give something away? I said, I feel good. Makes me feel good inside. Makes me feel grateful. He goes, well, what damn right do you have to take that feeling away from somebody who wants to give you something? Knock me over with a feather. Another lesson. Through the mouths of people in AA. I believe through the mouths of God. I hear God in AA all the time. When people speak, I believe that God's speaking through them. So anyway, Brenda came out of the coma. but she lost her memory. She didn't know who I was. She didn't know who my kids were. At that time, we had just had our third child. And there was a movie that came out not too long ago. I actually experienced it more than 10 years ago, called The Vow. I actually had to make my wife fall in love with me all over again. And I did my best to do that. But at that time now, I had to take care of not just her. See, when I worked, I believed that I was the only one that should work and she should stay home with the children and be able to take care of them. And so I would work a second job sometimes in order to accomplish that. Now I had to take care of her and the children. So I had to find some time from someplace. I was spending a lot of time at AA meetings. So I decided instead of 9, I went to 6, down to 3, down to 1 a week, eventually down to none. I didn't drink, though. I was still happy. I was still living the program because I had my network of friends and I had my spirituality. Well, that network of friends, that phone started getting heavier and heavier. Had too much time invested in the children and in the wife. I was working. So those friends started to go by the wayside. I still didn't pick up a drink, though. I was still happy in my life. I was still able to praise God because He had given my wife another chance. He had given me another chance to be with her. And then the spirituality that I had, which I thought was thick as a rope, it was thicker than anything. I was oozing spirituality. I found out was tied to the single church that I was going to because I heard two ladies talking disparagingly about my wife during one service. They didn't know I was around the corner, but they said, "No, she's coming here. Why does she even bother? She can't care for her kids. She can't remember anything, this, that, this." And I said, "If this is what this church is about, I'm out of here." That was the AA relapse trifecta, I call it, because it was not more than a month later that I picked up that drink. And it was a 22 or 24, I don't know, Foster's Lager, one of those big oil cans. I got one of them on the way. My friend asked me to go to a Ranger game, Ranger Savers game. And I took two cans of those, and I drank them on the way there, and I had a drink at the Madison Square Garden, and I came home, and one of the worst things ever happened to me that night. Absolutely nothing. I didn't get drunk. I didn't get arrested. I didn't get chastised by my wife. After all, I was in a perfect relationship now because she could not remember from day to day. I would get obnoxiously drunk. It took me about all of 3 weeks to get back up to a half gallon of vodka, which is where I stopped at. And I would get belligerent and nasty and right back into that ism. Boy, that alcoholism came back in spades. And she would forget the next day, and I certainly wasn't going to remind her. And that went on for 10 years. 10 years. It came to the point where I ended up in Warren Hospital with congestive heart failure, all sorts of other ailments. They took me in. They put IVs in me. They said, "Do you have a problem with drinking?" I said, "No. No. After all of this, no, I don't have a problem with drinking." I said, "Why do you ask?" They go, "You're shaking." And I said, "I don't shake." And I put my hands out, and I was like this. And one thing led to another. I went through the DTs that night, and I saw stuff that I don't ever want to forget. They were evil, dark things. The fear that gripped me was the fear. The only way I could explain it is if those that have parents, or those that have children, rather, the fear that I felt that night was if I had my two youngest children with me, one in each hand, and I was walking down a busy street, and two guys came up, snatched each one of them, and ran in opposite directions. What way do I go? That's the fear that I had that night in my heart. And so I was pretty much resigned to die, and I had a good health insurance policy, a life insurance policy, rather. If I died, my wife would probably get $1 million. She was probably ready to off me a couple times after that. But, yeah. I came right back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous after that, and that was on December 7th of 2010. So I will be coming up, God willing, on 3 years in December. And I didn't forget all of the stuff that I learned the first time around in AA. A lot of that stuck with me, but I started redoing the steps again, and I did them as Jack Witt, only with another sponsor. And that sponsor now has taught me more life lessons. Almost, Jack took me like from kindergarten through sixth grade. This new sponsor now has taken me into high school. And I'm learning as I go along more and more. My relationship has never been stronger with my wife. I love my wife more than I ever have in our marriage. And like I said, we're going to be married coming up on 25 years. My wife now has her memory back. All right? So there is really no ill effects. Everything came back. God's prayers. Again, grace. Grace from God coming down for 100% restoration. One thing that I've learned in this program is it took me many, many years to destroy and to create havoc and wreckage in my past. Many years to do that. And I found out that God could restore those relationships in what an eye flash. Just a blink of an eye, He could restore those relationships. He did in my life. And I know it can happen to other folks. So today I have a handful of sponsees, and I have a couple alleged sponsees. Those are the ones that don't really call very much or are doing off doing their own thing. I don't believe in chasing sponsees around, but the ones that I do have, I'm taking them through the book as Jack took me through the book, and I'm living their life experiences with them. Relationship problems, money problems, you name it. It's been done. If I find that I don't have experience in what they're going through, I either send them towards my sponsor if he has it, or I have a network of guys in this program, especially in the Bloomsbury area, that I trust with my life. I would take a bullet for them, and I would travel anywhere in the world to get them if they called me. That's the special bond that I have with those guys, and I will pass that question off to them because one of them will have had that same experience. And that strength and that hope that I look for in this program. So today, my life is my life couldn't be better. All last year, I was unemployed. That pharmaceutical company that I got promoted, shut down, and so I lost my job. But they gave me a gracious severance package that enabled me to double up and triple up and quadruple up on my AA for a whole year. I was able to do what the book says. What very few could do is spend 100% of the time in the work. Well, God offered an opportunity up that I said, far be it from me to surpass this. This is Him saying, hey, you need to go back to work. So I did. So I'm going through a life change event again, back to work. No naps in the summer, you know, in midday or whatever. And, you know, no going off whenever a sponsee calls. But it's a good thing because my sponsees have now grown up along with me, and somebody explained it. Time to leave the nest. Time to go out and get your own sponsees and just keep spreading this message of experience, strength, and hope. And I hope that's what I've done tonight, and I thank you all for being here and for Jeff for inviting me over for this meeting. You guys are fantastic, and thank you.